So James, today we're going to get back in the dirt once again, talk about emergence and training. And you know, there's that old joke about we're going to keep on training and eventually we might actually get it right.
Yeah, except every year what right is changes, so that doesn't help any.
Mother Nature.
Nah.
That fickle bitch.
Yes. We do need to address this because, you know, we're trying to stay timely with the season and certainly for our growers. And sorry, brewers, but it's go time for North American hops. So this is what you're going to hear a lot of. Training is so incredibly important to get the timing right. You know, when to train. I hear this all the time. You know, when is the right time to train my hops? Or when hops emerge out of the ground, it's like, well, should I cut back? I read it. You're supposed to cut back. And how many times should I cut back? And when should I cut? How much time should be between cutting back and training? And you know what? My favorite phrase, it depends.
Oh, that is the most frustrating thing you say.
It is, but it's true. And there's so many things that it depends on. You know, it's variety dependent. It's location dependent. It is harvesting style dependent. So there's very few things, very few absolutes that I speak to in hop production. Because, you know, there is a, you know, it's Mother Nature and everybody has a little bit different way to do it. But the one absolute that I tell people at every conference, at every opportunity I have, and here's another platform, here is pretty much the one absolute that I'll give you for hop growing. If anybody tells you they can say exactly when you need to cut back and train your hops, they are lying to you. What they know is when to do it for their place. Or they really don't understand the process at all and they're just regurgitating what they've read somewhere. So I just thought we ought to take time and talk about the facts. And hopefully that'll lead people to ask more questions and start to understand their plants a little bit better.
So you're saying the one absolute you have to give us is that there is no answer to this question.
There is no single right answer to this question.
And that's all the time we have today.
Sorry, thank you very much. there, you get back 48 and a half minutes. Yeah, there is no absolute right answer to it, and it infuriates people. But this is part of the University of Mother Nature. What I can tell people about this is I can't tell you when to do it because every year it's going to change. But what I can tell you for is what to look for and why it's important. Hopefully that's good enough to get them kickstarted to learn more about the plant and pay more attention to these really key factors happening in their hop yard that'll trigger them to do something at any given point.
I have to make the comment based on what you just said before we dive too deep into this, that so many things about hop production, about all farming really, have to do with paying attention and being observant and watching. And so many of the calls I would get when we were doing Gorse Valley and helping people out was, well, my farm's an hour from here and I'm just there on the weekends, but I still want to grow hops. And this is one more example of why you must be present to do something like this, because every day things change.
Constantly. People find this hard to believe, but they say, what do you mean? It's no big deal. It's just a week. I'll be up there on Saturday. Too late. And they say, what do you mean too late? I still got flower, you know, a crop last year. Oh, I'm sure you did. How much? And that's the differentiation. People will say, oh, you know, I get yield every year. And look, you know, my plants are 3 years old and they're as big around as a coffee can. And I still harvest by hand. Well, you're doing something wrong. And 9 times out of 10, you're training at the wrong time. So we thought we could dig into that and I could throw out a little bit of data and maybe prompt people to take a deeper dive into some of our online workshops on this topic, because it's more than we can discuss here from a technical side. But I'd add that I want to talk to you about, you know, and get your input on some of these other aspects that people really take for granted when it comes to this early season. They really want to get going and it's so exciting, but you know, how much do you have to do and how short a period of time do you have to do it? And do you have the resources to get it done?
Sure. And a lot of that stuff, you know, you started this conversation saying that, hey, brewers, take a chill here. It's time to talk about this because we're right in the season for all of this planting stuff. The things we'll get into on the business side, if you haven't done them already at this point, you've missed it. So we're already late for a lot of that.
It sucks to already be behind the eight ball, but it's what we call that farming. So why don't we just get all the big hairy technical stuff out of the way first and talk about, you know, the relationship between when these plants wake up out of dormancy, we call that emergence. And then training, obviously, when we're physically tying these, you know, wrapping these binds around twine to climb up the trellis, and yield, because they're directly related and massively so. Every variety has a different emergence period. They all require a little more or a little less sleepy time in order to be vigorous for the following year. And, you know, I say every variety, and it really is. You can kind of group them together into hop families. But you know, for instance, something like Chinook here in south central Wisconsin, it will, you know, wake up as soon as the snow's gone and you get some nice sunny days and just grow like crazy. And it's one of the last ones to harvest in the season. Yet Tettnanger and Saaz are the very last ones to wake up. And they'll be the first ones to harvest.
And I think you've said this before, that even though we just finished saying that you can't predict every year exactly when things will be ready, you can be fairly certain that your order of varieties will kind of fall like dominoes in that same order.
Yes, absolutely. That's genetic more than anything else. How many chilling hours they require, and then how long it takes them to come out of dormancy. But when to train, you know, how long do I let them grow? Like Chinook, if you've got Chinook that's growing like wildfire and it's got binds that are 4 feet long, even before Tettnanger's, you know, 6 inches long, am I just supposed to train those Chinook and let them go? Or do I cut them back? Or what do I do? What's the optimum thing to do? Well, it depends. Sure, right. So we have to take a look at when we expect these things to top out or hit the top wire. We call that topping out. You know, that's going to depend on how quickly these things grow vegetatively. Now, we know hops, yeah, they say, wow, they grow so fast, like, you know, they're weeds. They are, but some grow more quickly than others, like the example I've been giving. Chinook versus like a Tettnanger or a Centennial. Ideally, what we want to do is we want to time top out to coincide with the end of June or the summer solstice. And that does a few things without, and we could talk ad nauseum about hop physiology, which I won't. You're welcome.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
But, you know, there's a lot of complex plant hormonal activity going on when that plant reaches the top and the growing tip flops over. And you start forcing sidearms, and sidearms are where the flowers really should be forming. They shouldn't be forming on your central bind. What we want to do is we want to work our way backwards to know when should we get that plant trained so that it will reach the top of the trellis. It'll top out by the end of June. If I get a Chinook that's awake, let's say in April and actively growing, it's going to top out by end of May. You're going to be a month too early. And then it just keeps bushing out and bushing out and bushing out. And you've not hit the optimum combination of plant height and the summer solstice, where the day length changes, and sidearm development. So what you're going to end up with is a lot of vegetatively bushy hops, hop plants, and very little hop cones. And if you do have sidearms, they're going to be very short, and your yield's going to be all screwed up. So, James, what should I do then? Well, so what you're telling me is I have to slow these things down. Yep. Well, how do I do that? Well, you would cut them back. So the first flush would come up. They'd start growing like nut jobs, and you'd cut them or burn them back physically. You'd cut all that growth off or burn it back chemically. That forces that plant to send up new buds, new shoots. and, you know, can set that plant back a few weeks. And so we play this game of cutback to help synchronize when the plant emerges and when we train it so that it reaches the top of the wire or topping out at the right time of the year. Does that make sense?
It does. It makes a lot of sense. It's a very tricky thing to master, and it just takes experience.
And you can imagine that, you know, once these plants wake up, their growth is driven strictly by a concept we call growing degree days, which is a horticultural fancy term of saying how much heat units, you know, temperature, do these plants soak up over a given period of time. And up in, you know, till you get into the high 80 degree Fahrenheit range, the more heat, the faster they grow. So if you've got a really warm spring and these babies wake up and they are just going to be off to the races, well, next year you could have a cold spring and they're going to be slow. So anybody that tells you you got to cut back your Chinook on April 12th every year is full of shit, because it's going to depend on what the weather's doing.
So day to day, things could change.
Day to day, things will change. Here's something that just really ground my gears a couple of years ago. We had one of those years where the previous year we had a warm spring, very warm spring. For south central Wisconsin, we had 70 degrees in the end of March. The soil warmed up, the crowns broke dormancy, and the shoots started coming. I said, oh, you know what? It's going to cool off again. We're going to get cold rain. It's really going to slow these plants down. Wrong. And so what happened, James ended up missing his optimal cutback or burnback window, to the point where, oh, now it's too late. If I burn back now, I'm going to completely blow my training time. Instead of training in the second or third week of May, I would be training into June. I wouldn't have enough time to get a good crop. So I just let him go. And guess what happened? I got a really bad crop. The next year, I said, all right, we're on the ball now. Paying attention, paying attention, paying attention. Here comes that warm spring. You know, it was the beginning of April. Just a little earlier than right now. And boom, you know, 65 degrees, sunny, for like a week and a half, 2 weeks, they start coming. I see, okay, we're getting into the last week of April. It's still looking pretty warm. All right, time to go. Burn these babies back. And we want to burn them back too to help control downy mildew spores and stuff that are coming up. But frankly, it's more about controlling emergence timing. I burned them back, pat myself on the back, have 6 pints of beer. I'm an awesome guy. We had the coldest May on record.
Of course.
Everything stopped. And it was 45 degrees and raining. Son of a bitch. So guess what happened that year? I got a really shitty crop because the plants never caught back up. Welcome to farming, right? We call that paying tuition at the University of Mother Nature.
Ugh.
So people like, well, what am I going to do? How am I supposed to know? You get, develop your farmer's intuition, because that's really what it comes down to.
Before you go further, I'd like you to explain briefly burning them back.
So you get a bunch of napalm. No, although I suppose technically that would do it. So burning back, also called cutting back, and some people call it carping if you're from the UK or from Europe. Ultimately, one way or the other, what you're doing is you're physically removing the early growth. So you're physically removing it by either cutting it. So like some people on small scale use basically hedge clippers. Some people have a special mower that they go over the tops of these things with. Physically cutting, certainly in North America, isn't a good idea because it spreads virus and mildew spores all over the place. It's better to chemically burn back. We're using a herbicide that basically anything that green that it touches, it just dries it out. And it's not like Roundup or glyphosate or anything like that where it gets into the plant and kills it from the inside. It's just whatever it touches on the leaf, it dries it out. And it loses water and it dries up and that little part dies. Doesn't kill the whole plant. That gives you a much more controlled and thorough removal of all that vegetative tissue, that means it also gets rid very thoroughly of any downy mildew spores that have popped up through the soil that overwintered in some of if you've been in the hop yard, you'll see some of those buds that sort of stick up out of the ground over the wintertime. That's where the downy mildew spores like to hide and overwinter. So we burn all those off and we reduce our instance of seeing, you know, downy spikes and transmissions. So that's what I call, you know, burning back or cutting back. In the UK or in Europe, and even to some extent here in the US, because they do so much hilling up, so they'll actually go down through their rows during the season and throw soil up onto the crowns to bury weeds and whatnot. Well, you keep doing that throughout the season, you end up with this giant mound of soil. So they have to actually go through and cut all that down in the early spring. And so they call that carping, which is literally just this big horizontal circular saw blade that's going through and cutting into the crown and cutting everything back and reforming a small mound. That's the only reason they're doing it. You don't have to carp. You don't have to physically do that like they do in Europe. That's just one way of handling it. How's that?
That's great.
Is that good? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Lots of different, like I said, there's lots of different ways to do it, and not one is exactly right.
I think it's interesting there about the burning it back, your discussion about the downy mildew, because, you know, we talk a lot about nitrogen requirements and how important it is to have the right nutrients in the soil. And I think you'd be a very easy mistake to make if you're going to physically cut back to say, hey, great, vegetative material. Let's mulch this up and put it back in. And you're going to be putting a bunch of crap back in there if you do that. You want that out of the way.
Yeah, absolutely. We want to get rid of that stuff, which is why burning back desiccation is what it is, drying out that plant material, is a much better option. And that research has been studied very, very well. It's a lot of good data there from David Gent out in Oregon State. He did tremendous and still does tremendous research on downy and powdery mildew control. And we've adopted those practices in the Midwest and the Great Lakes states to great effect. So that is something that translates well from region to region. A couple of years ago, I did a study looking at taking Chinook and burning and cutting back one plot and leaving the other one go. And it really was just a matter of setting, you know, one treatment back by 2 weeks. And the resulting yield difference in the plot that I cut back, we hit just over 1,800 pounds of the acre. And the plot that we didn't and we just trained was at 920. 50% loss in yield because I trained too early. How's that for impactful?
Yeah. And as we said before, I mean, so many factors get in the way there. And you think one year you did something wrong, you overcompensate in the other direction. And you didn't really overcompensate. You just, Mother Nature had different plans.
As she usually does. Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So the burning back has a lot to do with early season mildew. Is there anything else that needs to be done? Or that can be done to deal with mildew, because it goes hand in hand with our comment earlier about, you know, living an hour away from your yard. Mildew in a in a day or two can turn the whole thing around.
Oh, it's insidious. Depending on how heavy the infection is in the yard, like if it's already there, or what the infection potential is, and there's a, like for downy mildew, there's a formula called the Downy Mildew and Risk Index, and you can calculate what your potential infection event is based on the weather. But for most yards anymore outside of the Pacific Northwest, you've got downy mildew in North America. So what we can plan on is that at emergence, if you know you've got a lot of systemic infection, even before you burn or cut anything back, the first thing we would typically do is a crown drench of a fungicide. And I'm not going to tell you which ones because every state's different and blah, blah, blah. And if you want a personalized recommendation, you know where the email address is. So we would do a fungicide drench as sort of a 1-2 punch. So first thing we're going to do, just in case we get an infection event, sporulation event, before we burn back. We want to get something on that plant to get into the crown, to get down into the rhizomes and systemically work from the inside out. Then we would go through and do our burn back, let the next flush come up, treat that stuff again, maybe not with as heavy of a drench, and then start our downy program, you know, every 7 days until we can get close to harvest.
I'm sorry, did you say sporulation event?
Sporulation.
You make so much of this shit up, I swear to God.
Why do you think I spent so many years in school? I get to chain a bunch of syllables together and make it sound impressive.
You have an English to Horticulturist dictionary over there?
I do, yes. Yes, I do.
I do want to comment, you were talking about the fact that every state is different, and they certainly are. One thing that I know came up very often as we were working with new growers was having a certified pesticide applicator license.
Oh, good God, yes.
And it's, you know, you need to be licensed to put certain things down, and you need to know what you're doing.
You need to be licensed even to buy some of this stuff. So, I mean, it's no joke. And let's not fool ourselves here. Even for folks that are organic, you're still using compounds that you're putting on your hop yard. And even though you think that they're natural, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're safe. So I don't care if you're an organic grower. Having a pesticide applicator's license is an indispensable tool to teach you, if nothing else, how to do math really well. Farm math. Don't delay. Go take your test.
And that is different state by state.
Yes. Yep, it totally is. And so are the chemicals that you can use. But I think we'll save that for another discussion. So I want to break up my techno babble with a bunch of bizno babble.
Sure.
And so that's your gig.
Oh, okay.
And I want to revisit this idea of planning. And we talked about how timing is horticulturally important, right? We get to the dirty details on the growing part, but timing is equally as important in how you plan for business execution.
It is. And it's that old adage of failure to plan is planning to fail. You don't go out in the field and say, oh, it's time to train. I better get some twine. That twine better be sitting there soaking and ready to roll.
Because that never happens.
No, never happens. The number of frantic emails and phone calls we used to get. I need some twine. It's you and everyone else. It's too late. So twine most often comes from overseas. It's not being manufactured in North America. Or if it is, it's just too expensive. We used to get ours from Sri Lanka. And we would order it in the November-December time frame to have it on the farm in February or March. If you're going to, you know, you're going to need this stuff. And, you know, there's sisal rope that can work. Most folks will use coconut fiber twine. That's the standard. Sisal is the stuff they use in cat trees.
Yeah, it's the old school baler twine that they used to, you know, tie up straw bales with, not the plastic stuff. Mm-hmm. And certainly there's like different grades of sisal twine for balers. You'd want to go with like the medium to heavyweight stuff, not the cheapo stuff.
And what's important there is how it reacts to your harvesting equipment, because that, you know, and when I say reacts to, it's the nice way of saying doesn't beat the shit out of your harvesting equipment.
or you know, melt and get inside the bearings and cause you to break down every 30 minutes.
Yeah. If you've got a teenage girl with long hair and she's ever gotten too close to a fan, this is kind of the concept we're talking about here.
Yeah, the plastic baler twine is just god awful because it will, at least for our harvesters, would gum up the choppers that are supposed to chop up all the plant material. And then you've got what? What do you got? You got a bunch of plastic chopped up shreds inside of your plant material that you're going to compost. Now what are you going to do with it?
Well, so many bad things going on there.
Yeah, totally.
So, but from a timing perspective, regardless, you know, which twine you pick, that's probably a different conversation. But ordering this stuff, as I said, we were getting our orders in 6 months before we needed the supply. Every year we had folks calling, hey, do you have some extra twine? I need to buy some twine. No. And the fact that you're getting it from overseas, there's lead time involved. We would always get calls toward the season from foreign vendors wanting to sell us stuff at the last minute, but the prices, of course, were crazy because they knew at that point you were late and you'd pay what you had to pay. There's all sorts of hardware. You need to have clips. You need to have that in advance. And you've got to do that balancing act between how much inventory do I want to have on hand and that may be sitting for a season or more versus do I really want to be running out to the hardware store or waiting on a delivery when I should be in the field working?
Yeah, that's a good point. How much of that? I mean, that's the stuff you had time to do in January.
It is, and you balance it with the cost of carrying inventory. There's the ideal world for every business is just-in-time inventory. You order what you need when you need it. You have exactly what you need, and you hang that last rope and put in that last clip, and dust your hands back and forth and say, "Voila, I did it perfectly." No one's that good.
No, it never happens that way. And the most successful growers that I know probably carry an extra year's worth of twine inventory, and they're ordering a year ahead, or they'll order 2 years at a time, and they won't go through a broker. They'll go direct to the manufacturer overseas. And in order to get, a shipment in a 20-foot container, you're going to be ordering 50 bales. And a bale's 2,600 strings or so. So it's like, well, if you're a 1 acre grower, that's going to last you forever. But that's how we started selling it, because we'd have to get it. There was no other option. And growers would start to rely on us, but probably too much so, right? Where they could just, oh yeah, Gorse Valley will have it. Oops.
Yeah, and that's the problem we had with growers we'd worked with year after year who didn't place an order 1 year, and to your point, assumed we would be there and we would have it. Well, no, because we don't want to be in the selling twine business when we should be out in the field working.
Right.
And anything we don't sell, okay, it's there for us for next year. All good.
Yep, it's not like we weren't going to use it, but it is a cash flow issue.
Yep. There's no business I'm aware of where you're like, I'll throw some more money at that. It's fine. You're trying that delicate dance of how much do I have to put into this inventory? Because really, the end of the season rolls around, you look at that huge pile of twine or those boxes and boxes of clips and say, okay, those were dollars that I could have used to spend on our next topic, which is labor.
Yeah, talk about something that you can't put in inventory.
Oh. You have enough trouble just getting it in the door.
Exactly.
Labor, th this is not pleasant, hanging twine. Know it because I've done it.
Or training. I
Or
think
training,
training's
yeah.
worse, because now you're bent over all the time, It's like, ugh.
Yes, I would tend to agree with you that that training is difficult, extremely difficult. You need day labor to get this stuff done. And depending on where you're located, that's not always readily accessible. It can be very expensive, and you've got to plan for it accordingly because you do need that help. Your friends are not going to come over and train for you and hang twine for you. They're just not going to do it. If they're remotely smart, they won't do it. And if they do it, they'll only do it once.
Yeah, and I think this is a topic, training and twine, hanging twine, where scale becomes an incredibly important multiplier.
Yeah.
Having run a 1 acre hop yard, yeah, guess what? You can hang an acre's worth of twine nights and weekends over a couple weeks just yourself, and you can get it done. Training over, a long Saturday with a couple of friends and have some beer at the end of the day, and that's all good. 5 acres, 20 acres, forget it. That's not the way you're going to do it. So this really is a topic where you have to determine if you're a hobbyist or you're running a business, because it can't wait and it's going to cost you money to do.
And that scale, your efficiency, with many things, as you scale up, you can gain efficiencies. This is one where I think you lose efficiencies in the sense that when you've got tight control over what's going on, your time per acre is going to be set pretty well, because it's you, it's your partners, it's folks you've got eyes on getting all that done. Once you're scaling out and you've got day labor who you're explaining what to do and saying go do it, but your competence, I'll say, at this particular thing, which takes skill, is going to reduce with the more fresh bodies you're bringing onto the farm.
And you tend to burn through fresh bodies as day laborers. Mm-hmm. And so there's constant, no pun intended, retraining just to keep people operational. Yep. And one of the luxuries that the Pacific Northwest has is that, they've got, H2A labor from outside the country that have been coming to the same farm for 30 years. These people already know what they're doing. And they can just go like all get out and, knock out 25 acres in a day. I would have trouble getting 8 people to show up to get, a half an acre done a day. So as you scale up, it's just no laughing matter that the amount of labor that you need in such a short period of time is critically important. And if you don't have it, there's oftentimes just no way you're going to get it all done in time.
Yeah. There's really those three difficult components all, and they magnify each other. There's just the hourly expense. There's the lack of availability of those bodies. And there's the lack of efficiency, especially when, to your point, you're replacing and retraining folks over and over again. You never really get those efficiencies. So those three components multiplied against each other is money just falling out of your pockets.
A hole down which to stuff money. Mm-hmm.
You might as well buy a boat or a horse at that point.
Let me share with you all the various labor avenues that we've experienced. So there's the Craigslist labor. And I would say that for every response I got from a Craigslist posting, I'd say for every 10, I maybe got one person that actually was worth anything, if I was lucky.
So when you say worth anything, I thought you were going to say you got one that actually showed up. What percentage actually showed up?
Oh, I'd say probably out of every 10 inquiries, I'd get maybe 3 or 4. And then to have, of the 3 or 4, one of them actually be worth anything and want to stick it out. That's not a great return when you need on a 15 acre yard, I would need 8 people easy even to just start, because, we had a big scaffold and we'd have 6 people up top and 2 people on the bottom staking in. So getting enough people even to just get started was a challenge. Then I went to a labor service, like a temp service, day labor service. You're paying a premium for that because, at least they say, oh, you don't have to worry about, we'll send you, you tell us how many people you need and we'll send them out. Well, okay. Let's say I'm going to, pay them. They're going to say, what's your day rate? Oh, $15 an hour. They'd end up charging, invoicing you back, $19 or $20 an hour because they got to make their cut. For $20 an hour for absolute base rate physical labor, yowza, needs must. And so I would use that in an emergency. Not very good one either, because oftentimes you'd never, the same 2 days in a row, you wouldn't have the same people. So that just, was awful.
And I have to imagine we ran into the situation where we had to redo some of that work.
Oh, constantly. And even from people that were there for a week or 2 weeks, you say, what the hell were you thinking? It's not like you can just let them go off, give them 2 hours of the training. No, you're on top of them all the time. It was even worse with training because you'd say, okay, you only train clockwise. All right. So they'd start training clockwise and they'd do it right for a half or a row and a half. And then they'd all be trained the other way around. And those are just going to unwrap themselves. And so you'd be like, okay, no, stop. What's going on? Oh, sorry. Yeah, whatever. They're talking to their mates or they're listening to podcast or something. Really not paying full attention. Or there's a significant language barrier because you're using, ethnic or migrant labor. That poses a whole nother host of issues. Mm-hmm. I could usually get by with, throughout the rest of the year, up until even through harvest with, you know, local labor or Craigslist help, or even when we got larger, you know, we'd have full-time seasonal employees. But that few weeks and early, you know, it's just tough because you get through training or you get through hanging twine, but the plants aren't ready to train yet because they're all still way dormant. So not all those people go away, and now you got to find more people to come back and train.
Now, what about, so there's the day labor side. What about students?
What about them?
We used to get a lot of emails from local university students who were in agriculture programs and would do anything to help out a farm and just see how things went. I imagine they would show up for half a day, see it was hard, and then go back to the library.
Well, right. The issue was, it was the wrong time of year for them. We'd say, okay, yep, we're really going to be pounding it in April and May. And they're like, oh, that's the end of the semester for me. I can't do that.
They've got exams. Yep.
Yeah. So they say, but I can come out right after that, and it's the end of May, too late. Or I'd say, you know what? That's fine. You looking for a weeding job? Because that's what I got. If you how badly do you really want to learn the hop business? come on out and hand weed for 2.5 months, and we'll see if you've got what it takes. But students really weren't all that great. We tried to get high school students in. And this is a story, and I will say it, Wisconsin Heights School District. I went to them because the band was having trouble. They couldn't fund their uniforms or the program. The sports teams didn't have any money. And so I said, how about this? I will make donations to your programs because I got to spend this money anyway, if your kids come out here and do this work. And all the teachers loved it. They're like, oh my God, this is great. You know, and I added up how much labor it was. I'm like, well, you know, you need, you know, $6,500 for whatever band uniforms or something like that. Here you go. The money's right here waiting for you. You just got to get your kids out here to, you know, do the training on the weekend or whatever. Took it up to the principal and the school board. They said absolutely not, because they didn't want to have anything to do with the alcohol industry.
Oh, sure.
And I said, oh, how many of these kids' parents are corn farmers? And they're like, what do you mean? I said, well, where do you think that corn's going? Right? It's not going to animal feed. It's going to the ethanol plant. So they're in the alcohol business one way or the other. But yeah, we couldn't even get high school help. Maybe some folks could, and you know, God bless you if it works, but we couldn't get it. So.
And that's a great way of, you know, we've talked about local, we've talked about community, of trying to partner and help the local community and get some help back in return. That's a shame that they were shutting down like that.
Yeah, you know, what are you going to do? You make do with what you've got. You know, 2 hours further north from where we were was a massive vegetable growing region, and most people don't know that in Wisconsin, you know, we're one of the largest producers of carrots and celery and potatoes and snap beans and all kinds of stuff, and all that sweet potatoes now too, and a lot of that requires hand labor. So there'd be very large groups of basically migrant within the state going from one crop to the next to the next. And if you could actually get them onto your hop yard to do the twine tying, imagine letting them go and then trying to get them back to train when you're competing with all these other much larger, more lucrative farms. So it's like, boy, if you got them on there, you want to keep them busy. So you're finding all kinds of other stuff for them to do. So
it's a resource nightmare. And, you know, we spoke about the fact that when it comes to the hardware side of things and the twine, you've got to plan that well in advance. It's really the same for labor. You can't wait until you need the labor to go looking for the labor. And yet so many of these methods we talked about do involve, okay, I need you tomorrow. I mean, I don't know that you can line up day laborers months in advance necessarily.
Not really. And hopefully you'd over the years, you know, build a rapport with some of the folks, because some people like to do that work, the gig economy, right? That's all they do. And, you know, we found two that ended up doing this kind of work with us for years. And they'd say, yeah, then I'm going to go over and do this. And then, you know, you're going to need me in another month. Yeah, why don't you come back? Okay. And then they'd come in, they'd do whatever, and then they'd go away, and they'd come and say, you gonna need me for harvest? Yep. And then they'd come spend 6 weeks for harvest, and then they'd go away again. But that's just what they like to do. But those are rare, rare gems when you find them.
So from a resource perspective there, I think we've covered all of that. What else from a plant perspective do we need to touch on here?
The other thing that you're doing during this early season time frame is getting your pre-emergent herbicide down, because weed pressure is the other big killer of yield in your hop yard and a harborer of downy mildew and insect pests. So getting that pre-emergent down, I don't care what you're using. I don't care if it's hand weeding, you're mulching, you're doing whatever, but early season weed control is absolutely critical. And typically most pre-emergents are going down even before emergence is happening. So very early season, like right now here in Wisconsin, the southern Wisconsin, the snow's gone. The pre-emergent is going down right now. And once that soil warms up and those seeds start to wake up, you want to make sure the pre-emergent's on well before that. Hand weeding, if need be. Some folks are putting on straw mulch, things like that. But I would say, aside from that, it really is gearing up to do these two big slugs of work, keeping an eye and keeping damn good records on what the weather's doing this year, you know, temperatures, emergence times. I mean, we had soil temperature, soil moisture, growing degree days, all kinds of stuff, so we could track year over year when did we emerge, when did we burn back, when did we train, what was the yield. And so we start building trends and looking at this, saying, aha, when the conditions look like this, I need to do this. And then when this variable changes, what am I going to do? And then you make those notes and you do it. Did it work? Yeah. Did it not work? Eh, not so much. Well, you make those notes and you don't do it again. That's how it works. That's why 4 and 5 generation hop growers have such an advantage over we non-traditional growers, because this is all institutional knowledge for them, and we have to figure it out for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And then you still get a hurricane with 80-mile-an-hour winds, and it all goes to shit.
Oh, totally, yeah. I remember standing outside. It was, we were just topping out, so it was like the 3rd week of June, and we get a freak hailstorm. And the cloud came over, and it was like 7:30 at night, and I was home. And all of a sudden, I hear it ping, 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 and it was like pea size. And I got my phone out and I started the stopwatch. It was 37 seconds of hail, ruined my entire crop. That was it. That's all it takes. Uh-huh. I could have done everything right up to that point. And I, of course I did. I was so good. I hit everything on the head. I was just such a superstar. It's just like that fish that got away. But yeah, it's all it takes. Those are the perils of farming. Oh, yeah. So
we will at some point get into the business side of crop insurance.
Oh yes, absolutely. And we've got a couple of friends that would like to chime in on that. Maybe give us some information there. But yeah, that's a whole nother ball of wax. So, well, I think we probably filled up people's brains with this much. I will tell people that here shortly, if it's not up already, on our online Hop University webinar stuff, that there'll be quite a bit of information and data looking at emergence and burn back and training timing and how it affects yield. So if you really wanted a deep dive into what's going on, you could take a look at that and some of our other modules that you know, cover infrastructure costs and labor scheduling and all that kind of stuff for a much deeper dive.
Excellent. And something else that we'll have out shortly, you were talking earlier about not boring us with too much about hop physiology. I'm thinking we'll do a spin-off podcast called Hop Physiology for Insomniacs.
Oh, yes.
And we'll have some ocean sounds behind you just going into the genus and phylum and species and all that. And anyone who has trouble sleeping, this is going to help.
Do I have to get real close and talk real low and we can do ASMR? Hop ASMR.
See, now I'm going to have nightmares, so that's kind of the opposite of the insomniac problem.
Well, that's the wheezing and the asthma. That's really what the problem is. So, all right, that's all I got.